assume what I have sworn to do." He swayed on his feet, bread knife high in the air. Penelope understood his mind at once. "Monster! They are your own grandchildren. Would you sacrifice them too?" "Of course not, governess." His dark eyes glittered. "I need only one."
"Children, stand back," Penelope yelled, lunging toward the madman. "He means to harm the babies."
What happened next happened all at once, in the blink of an eye. It was one of those moments when people's true natures are revealed, for when there is no time to think, one can only act from the heart. Of course, to write it all at once would turn the page into an inky blotch, which would be as difficult to read as invisible ink. Instead, imagine the following events happening in concert, the way the instruments of an orchestra commence playing together at the swoop of the conductor's baton.
"That's Cook's best bread knife! You hand that back right now!"
Mrs. Clark bellowed, reaching for Edward Ashton's upraised arm.
"Awoo!"
With a howling battle cry, teeth bared and fists raised, the incorrigibles rushed to the defense of the babies by forming an incorrigible pyramid in front of the cradle. Cassiopeia stood with one foot each on the shoulders of her brothers.
"Stop this instant!"
Penelope cried as she flung herself between Edward Ashton and the incorrigibles.
"Blast! That's no way to behave in front of my wife!"
Lord Frederick leaped forward to seize Edward Ashton from behind. Simon Harley Dickinson, still on the floor, sprang to his feet and shouted,
"Oh, no, you don't!"
He put his head down and charged at Edward Ashton like a furious bull charging at a matador's red cape. Alas, due to his poor eyesight, Lord Frederick missed his target and ended up sprawled on the carpet. Mrs. Clark got hold of Ashton's free arm, but madness and fury had roused his last surge of strength, and she was dragged behind him as he lurched toward the cradle. Simon's head caught him square in the belly, which caused him to double over, groaning. His knife-wielding arm buckled, and somehow it was good luck for Ashton, but bad for Simon, hooked itself round Simon's neck with the gleaming knife edge pressed against the young bard's throat. No one dared speak, except for one person. It was the person who had been bravest of all that day. Clearly she had bravery left to spare.
"You'll leave Mrs. Penworthy alone!"
Lady Constance Ashton yelled. Unable to get out of bed, she hurled the very last chocolate on her tray at the attacker. The chocolate hit Ashton in one eye, knocking him sideways. That was all the chance Simon needed. He twisted free. With a blind sweep, Ashton slashed the bread knife in Simon's direction, but caught only the horsehair wig, which was now impaled on the blade. By this time, Miss Mortimer and Mater Lumley had made it to the front ranks. They seized Ashton firmly, one on each side, as Pater Lumley grabbed Ashton's forearm with both hands. Still, the madman's white-knuckled grip held firm. The wig dangled comically from the knife's tip.
"Fools!" Edward Ashton cried. "Fools! Let me go! If the curse is not ended, we are all doomed. Don't you understand? Doomed, doomed!"
Lord Frederick squinted. "Bit dramatic there, don't you think? Here, I'll take that off your hands." Lord Frederick reached out for the bread knife, but his father only tightened his grip. Miss Mortimer spoke in that stern headmistress tone that no Swanburn girl had ever found the will to disobey.
"Edward, release that knife at once!"
But Edward Ashton was no Swanburn girl. He growled and snarled like a caught animal, and it was all they could do to hold him.
"I'll take care of this, Charlotte."
It was old Timothy, swaggering in the door like a captain on the deck of his own ship. He rubbed the fresh bump at the top of his skull and winced, but he seemed otherwise unharmed.
"You can put the knife down now, Eddie," he said in the same soothing tone he might use to calm a frightened horse. "There's a good lad. Now, give that to old Tim. Ta-dum, ta-dum, ta-dum," he murmured, as he reached one gnarled hand fearlessly toward the blade. It was uncanny to see how old Timothy's cooing voice acted upon the villain. Edward Ashton's face lost its twist of rage and went slack, and his grasp on the knife softened with each ta-dum. It was as if the coachman's words were a time machine that brought the trembling madman back to days long past, before years of murderous intrigue had twisted little Eddie Ashton's spirit into one fueled only by vengeance and fear. Old Timothy never let up his hypnotic murmuring.
"Good boy, Eddie. Just let it go. There'll be a treat in it for you. Just hand the knife over to your old friend Tim."
Through it all, Madame Ionesco stood swaying, eyes closed, humming softly to herself. One would have thought she was hardly paying attention, but the moment the knife dropped into old Timothy's hand, her eyes flew open.
"I'll take that, Timothy boy,"
she said, extending a hand. Old Timothy gave her the bread knife. Mrs. Penworthy's horsehair wig was still upon it.
"Go ahead with your singing and soothsaying, folks," old Timothy said. "I know when a horse is broke to harness, and this one surely is. I'll make sure he doesn't cause any more trouble. Come along now, Eddie. I'll bring you some place you can rest."
Meek as a lamb following his flock, Edward Ashton took old Timothy's arm. No one doubted that the enigmatic coachman had the situation well in hand this time, but Peter Lumley went with them, just in case. After they were gone, Lord Frederick rubbed his eyes.
"Blast! That fellow looked like Judge Quincy to me, but you all kept calling him Edward. Now I've got the strangest feeling. Is there something I'm missing?"
Before anyone could explain, a howl unlike any that had so far been heard that day echoed throughout the house.
"Oh!"
Then came an ear-piercing scream, like a thousand unoiled door hinges all swinging at the same time. Whatever Margaret had just seen had frightened her terribly. Thump, 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 thump. Heavy footfalls trotted menacingly up the stairs. The incorrigible children sniffed.
"Mama Wolf,"
Cassiopeia said. She sounded uncertain. Alexander shook his head.
"Not exactly," he said. "I smell ghosties,"
Beowulf added, with a gulp of fear. The door opened. This was no ordinary wolf, nor even a highly unusual wolf, but something far more strange and powerful. It was Mama Wolf on the outside, but it was not Mama Wolf on the inside. The children could tell this at once. Mater and Pater Lumley could not, but good manners were good manners after all. "My dear Mother Wolf," Mater Lumley said in a shaking voice, "if I could have written you a thank you note, I would have. We are so grateful for the excellent care you took of our children." The giant beast threw back its head.
"Oh! I am the sacred wolf of the Awoo-Awoo!"
Its voice shook the room, a thunder of rage and grief.
"I have come for justice, blood for blood, a pelt for a pelt."
Everyone looked at Madame Ionesco.
"Sometimes you have to wake the dead. Sometimes they wake up by themselves,"
the soothsayer shrugged.
"Saves me a lot of work, frankly."
The wolf swept its glowing eyes round the room and took in each terrified countenance.
"Murderer!"
This was aimed at Lord Frederick.
"I know you by your face, Ashton. And by your companion, that cabin boy who shadowed your every step."
"I beg your pardon," Lord Frederick replied, bewildered.
Simon Stage whispered in his ear.
"Freddy, she thinks you're the long-dead Admiral Ashton, who committed the rhymes with birder of her cubs, and that Miss Lumley here is Pudge, the cabin boy.
And I thought my eyesight was poor, Lord Frederick whispered back. Ought I play along? If it were me, I'd give the performance of a lifetime. Simon looked up. The enormous creature towered over them all. All right, Lord Frederick tugged at his collar. What should I say?
Madame Ionesco rolled her eyes.
Apologize, Fred. Do it like you mean it.
Right,
Lord Frederick cleared his throat.
Well, sacred wolf of Awoo-Awoo, may I call you Wolfie?
No,
the beast roared.
All right, I'll just get to it then. On behalf of the entire Ashton family, past, present and future, I'd like to say I'm sorry, really awfully sorry, about that business with the wolf cubs. It was a dreadful thing to do. We've all learned a great deal, and you won't be seeing any more bad behaviour from us. On my word, I am truly sorry.
He broke character.
Blast, I feel even worse about it now that I'm a father myself.
Madame Ionesco nudged him in the ribs.
And go on, the curse.
Yes, yes, almost forgot, he gulped. I sincerely hope you'll undo this curse you've put on us Ashtons. I do appreciate your consideration. What?
The wolf growled, long and fierce. Madame Ionesco listened hard.
Okay, I think she's saying maybe that's a good start.
I can speak for myself, the wolf roared. Sorry doesn't bring back my cubs. Why should I undo the curse?
To make peace, doggy.
Even the soothsayer looked frightened.
Let bygones be bygones.
Put the past behind us, so to speak,
Lord Frederick added. The wolf's fur bristled all along its back.
No, nothing can undo the past.
Madame Ionesco turned to the others and shrugged.
So sorry, guys. What's gonna happen? It's been a pleasure. I hope you all gruesome ends come quick and easy. I know it's not what we hoped for, but you win some, you lose some.
Wait! Nothing can change the past. It's true.
Penelope stepped forward till she was face to face with the frightening beast. The past is over. A sunk cost, if you will. All the pains and losses, the mistakes and misdeeds, none of these can be undone. The wolf's eyes glowed like torches in the dim room. Penelope took a breath and went on.
However, the terms of the curse are clear. They say that only one side of the family can remain, or both will perish. I would argue that only one side does remain.
She turned and gestured to the incorrigibles.
For here we have Alexander, Beowulf and Cassiopeia, and me, Penelope. We are the four Lumley children, the great-grandchildren of Agatha Swanburne.
Miss Mortimer's gentle smile and her mother's encouraging look gave her confidence. But so did the words of Agatha Swanburne, and the wisdom gleaned from every story of bravery and pluck she had ever heard or read. She turned toward the cradle.
And here we have the great-grandchildren of Agatha's twin brother, Pax. It was four generations ago that the family tree split in two. The curse foretold that we would always be at war with each other. That in order to survive, one side would have to throw the other to the wolves, so to speak. Yet, here we are.
Brothers and sisters,
Alexander said.
Sisters and brothers,
Beowulf chimed in.
And pets,
no doubt Cassiopeia was thinking of Nutsawoo. The wolf pulled back its lips in a snarl, revealing its deadly teeth. Mrs. Clark gasped, but Penelope was no longer the least bit afraid.
Lord Frederick, is it true that you told the incorrigibles that your own children were to be raised alongside them, like siblings?
Yes, I did. Simpler that way, what?
He turned to his wife.
You don't mind, do you, dear?
Lady Constance yawned prettily. What a long day she had had.
I do like simple things, Frederick,
she replied sweetly.
The simpler, the better.
Yes, as Occam's razor reminds us, Penelope stood by the incorrigibles.
And moments ago, when the lives of Lord and Lady Ashton's newborn babies were threatened,
It was these three brave children who ran to protect them. Was it not?
You did also, Penny dear, Miss Mortimer interjected. All four of you hurled yourselves into harm's way to save those innocent newborns.
She looked at the wolf and spoke imploringly.
The descendants of Agatha Swanburn stood ready to sacrifice themselves for the descendants of Pax Ashton. Surely that makes them one family again.
The spirit wolf's eyes narrowed to slits.
My cubs were slain for their pelts and perished on the blood-stained sands of a woo-woo. I demand blood for blood, a pelt for a pelt.
There were twin whimpers from the cradle, as the babies briefly roused and then sank back into their newborn dreams. Penelope racked her brains, but she had said everything she could think of to say. Was this what was meant by a hopeless case? When you had done your best, and it was still not good enough? Yet even a hopeless case was never without hope. This she believed to her very bones. Madame Ionesco frowned.
Blood and a pelt. You drive a tough bargain, doggy. All right, bring me that bowl of borscht, would you, big sister?
By now the soup was cold, but Penelope knew better than to question the mysterious madame. Carefully she lifted the tray and carried the bowl of rich red soup to the soothsayer. Madame Ionesco dipped one finger into the soup, took it out, and licked it.
Not bad, she said. Maybe add a little more dill next time.
The bread knife that held the horsehair wig lay at the foot of the bed. Madame placed it next to the soup and offered the whole tray to the wolf.
Here you go, doggy. Blood and pelt, just like you ordered.
That's not blood, that's borscht, Simon blurted.
Tell that to a beat.
Again, Madame Ionesco turned to the wolf.
Just try it, she urged. It's not bad.
The great beast nuzzled the horsehair wig with her nose and sniffed at the soup. Finally, she took a slurp. Her ears swiveled in surprise.
Grrr. It's good,
the creature said, and lapped up the rest. When she had licked the last blood-red morsels of borscht from her whiskers, the wolf swept her shining eyes round the room.
Oh, oh,
the wolf intoned.
Most unexpected. I came to witness the extinction of the cursed Ashtons, a family split in two. Yet now I cannot tell which side is which. Each of you was willing to sacrifice yourself for another.
That's because we are siblings, Alexander stood proudly next to the cradle. Brothers,
Beowulf said, joining him.
And sisters, oogie-woogie-woo,
Cassiopeia cooed at the babies.
And I am a mother, Lady Constance giggled. I can hardly believe it myself.
And I'm a father, it appears, Lord Frederick said happily, and patted his wife's hand.
I am a big sister, and some sort of cousin, said Penelope, looking at the children. And a daughter, she added.
Mater Lumley smiled.
And a niece, don't forget, put in Miss Mortimer.
I'm not sure what I am exactly, but I do feel part of the family, if you don't mind my saying so, Simon offered.
Shyly, he took Penelope's hand.
I'm just a soothsayer, don't mind me,
Madame Ionesco chuckled.
Does this mean that only one side remains? Penelope clutched Simon's hand in hope. Had the terms of the curse been fulfilled?
The wolf's cold yellow eyes softened to a burnished gold.
Two sides have turned to one, not through violence, but through compassion and kindness. The tree that was split down the middle has grown together once more.
A powerful wag of the wolf's great furry tail pushed aside the drapes, and the cool blue light of the first full moon of May shone brightly upon them all.
Oh!
The beast sang, full-throated. It was a song of forgiveness. Oh, oh! As there is one nose, one tail, and one moon in the sky, the Ashtons are again one family. Live long together and live in peace. The terms of the curse have been fulfilled. With that, the shimmering spirit of the sacred wolf of a woo-woo detached itself from Mama Wolf. It floated upward and hovered near the ceiling, then burst into countless sprays of gold that glittered in the air like fireworks. A moment later, it was gone.
Hooray!
Cried the incorrigibles, who understood that something marvellous had happened. Simon and Penelope hugged each other, and Mater and Pater Lumley embraced all their children in turn. Lady Constance beamed and yawned, for she had a very long day indeed. Her husband held her hand in one of his own, and used the other to rock the cradle that held the future of their new and no longer cursed family. Mama Wolf seemed dazed by the experience, but thanks to the nourishing borscht and some tasty sandwich meats offered by the children, she was soon quite herself again.
"That's a good girl,"
Madame Ionesco scratched the enormous beast on the muzzle as if she were a much-loved pet. The wolf did not seem to mind at all.
"Not what you expected, eh? But people change, doggy. People change."
Truly, the first full moon of May had turned out to be a day worth celebrating. No doubt Cook would have baked a cake for the occasion, had she known how well things would turn out. However, there was still one small betrayal left to settle. Simon rubbed bashfully at his head, which was far easier to do now that that itchy horsehair wig was off.
"Whoops! I guess I owe you an apology, Lady C," he said. "As you can tell, I haven't been completely honest with you."
Lady Constance merely laughed.
"No need to apologize, Mrs. Penworthy. Many a lady has resorted to artificial means when her own natural beauty was in need of a boost, as the Americans say. I have dabbled in a bit of rouge and lip tint myself now and then. But not to worry. My dressmaker, Madame Lepont, knows the finest wig makers in Paris. She can have a new wig made for you that is far more flattering." Her little nose wrinkled. "Your old one did you no favours, if I may speak frankly. One lady to another. It had a bit of a barnyard smell about it, too."
Simon, amazed, looked at Penelope, who was desperately trying not to laugh.
"Well, thanks very much. You're awfully kind, Lady C," he said, and curtsied as daintily as he could.
The incorrigibles nudged each other and looked pleased, for they enjoyed having both Simon and Mrs. Penworthy around, and now it seems that he, that is to say, they, would be able to stay on as the baby nurse after all. It made perfect sense to the children, for they were used to thinking with their hearts. Throughout all this, Lady Frederick only had eyes for his wife.
"You certainly don't need any rouge today, my dear," he said. "I can see you clear as day. You look radiant."
"Do I?" There was no mirror handy, but none was required. The truth of it was reflected on her husband's face.
"Well, I feel radiant. So there," she said merrily. "I believe motherhood suits me, Frederick."
Epilogue. By morning, Edward Ashton had disappeared. Old Timothy had locked him in the barn overnight. This was ironic, since the barn was where the incorrigible children had been put when Lord Frederick first found them in the woods. Yet it was not an unkindness on either occasion, for the barn was cozy and filled with clean hay and friendly animals. Old Timothy had stayed till Edward fell asleep. The man had shown no signs of violence or even resistance. The former lord of Ashton Place seemed reduced to a muttering simpleton. But when old Timothy returned in the morning to deliver breakfast, it was an excellent breakfast too, as Mrs. Clark herself had prepared a tray of hot porridge, jam, butter, and a basket of muffins, saying as she did so,
"If a bloodthirsty wolf who's been dead for ages can put the past behind her and move on, what excuse do the rest of us have for holding a grudge, I ask you?"
He was gone. A hollow in the bed of hay showed where he had slept, but the spot was cold. It seemed he had been gone for hours.
"We ought to start a hunting party, what?"
Lord Frederick said when told. By this time it had been explained to him who Quinsy really was, a revelation that Lord Frederick took rather well, given the circumstances.
"But a peaceful one, please, no weapons. He is my father, after all. Perhaps he's just hiding in the woods."
Everyone who could be spared went outside to join the search. This included Admiral Forsay, who had made his way to the house early, in time for a good breakfast and a much-needed shave, as well as a round of apologies for some past misdeeds, all of which were promptly forgiven. The children ran around the grounds and sniffed, but the sense of madness, meanness, and vengeance were nowhere to be found at Ashton Place. Old Timothy checked the stables, but no horses were missing.
"That means he must have escaped on foot,"
Beowulf deduced.
"But which one? The right foot or the left?"
Alexander swiveled his spyglass upward.
"Maybe not. Look!"
High in the sky, a multicoloured balloon lurched one way and then the other. Admiral Forsay splattered.
"My balloon!" "No worries, Forsay, old chap. I'll buy you a new one," Lord Frederick offered. "I'm still awfully rich, you know." "Most appreciated, sir, but I'm more concerned with the fellow inside. In the first place, he doesn't know how to fly it. In the second place, after my rough landing in the treetops, that balloon's in bad shape. I'd wager it's leaking hot air like, well, a faucet. It might stay up for a day or so, but that's it. And with the wind blowing the way it is..."
His voice grew ominous.
"He'll crash in the ocean, for sure."
The question of whether they ought to rescue Edward Ashton from certain death in a broken balloon might have posed an ethical dilemma had there been any chance of saving him, but already it was too late. The stolen balloon rose quickly, too quickly, according to Forsay, and the howls of its lone passenger could no longer be heard as the balloon shrank to a tiny smudge of rainbow in the sky. It blew topsy-turvy in an eastward direction, borne by fate and the prevailing winds toward the wide, unforgiving sea. As you might expect, Lord Frederick's feelings about this were mixed.
"Even a terrible father is a father," he said later, when they had all gone back inside to visit with Lady Constance and the babies. "Not having one is a pity, no matter how you slice it. I had one, lost one, found one. Now I've lost him again. It's upsetting. And now I'm a father too. I hope I have more of a knack for it than old Edward."
Lady Constance and the twins were being well cared for by Mater and Pater Lumley. Madame Ionesco and Mrs. Penworthy too. Her pony-scented pigtails had been replaced to great advantage with Simon's own unruly shock of hair, which tumbled quite naturally over his intelligent forehead. Pater Lumley put his arm around Frederick's shoulders.
"All parents make mistakes. You'll make some too."
Mater Lumley offered a clean pocket handkerchief, which Lord Frederick put to good use. Lady Constance looked up her husband with sympathy and gestured for him to come sit next to her.
"I have news that will cheer you, Frederick. I have thought of names for the babies. The little girl I would like to name Fern. Ferns are pleasant to be among and come in many varieties, so I am told. Therefore, I think the name will suit her no matter what sort of person she turns out to be." Penelope nearly clapped her hands in delight, for she was very fond of ferns. "And Frederick, dear, if it is all right with you, I think we ought to name the boy Edward, after your father."
"What?"
he exclaimed.
The worst of him was not very nice, true, but nobody is perfect. We can name our son Edward after the best of your father, in honor of the father you would like to be. I have complete faith in you, Frederick, Constance chirped.
Lord Frederick cheered up a great deal after he heard that. In any case, Fern and Edward needed diaper changes, again. And as the newly blessed Ashtons would soon learn, there is little time to worry about how to be a good parent when one is busy being one.
Penelope, who still felt remorse about the unpaid hotel and taxi bills she had left behind in Russia, was doubly committed to making sure the good fortune teller's expenses were settled promptly.
"Madame, I know your services do not come cheaply," she said, taking the weird woman aside. "If you would give me an invoice, I will take the matter up with Lord Frederick as soon as he has done changing diapers."
Would you,
the Lord of Ashton Place cooed as he put Fern, or was it Edward, back in the crib. Madame Ionesco patted Penelope's hand.
"No charge. It's a baby present. Times two."
Lord Frederick straightened.
"I'd best write down the birthday so I don't forget. Everybody likes to get a card on their birthday, what? Hand me my almanac, would you, old Tim?"
But the almanac was nowhere to be found.
"Where is that book?" he said, turning in circles. "It's uncanny. The blasted almanac still won't stay put."
Madame Ionesco chuckled.
"Sorry, Papa. I've been meaning to tell you. There's a little spell on your almanac. In Romanian, it's called... Well, in Romanian, it's complicated. Loosely translated, it's the other sock spell."
"Socks? What's that got to do with it?"
Lord Frederick asked.
"I bet I know," Simon exclaimed. "It's the spell that makes people lose the other sock, isn't it?"
Madame Ionesco grinned.
"You got it, baby nurse."
To the others, she explained.
"Long ago, in soothsayer time, which is not like the clock on the wall, by the way, one of my fellow fortune-tellers mixed up her agricadabras with a presto changos, and the other sock spell got loose. Now we can't get rid of it. You can't put a genie back in the bottle. Know what I mean? Anyway, Fred, somebody, it might have been me, put the other sock spell on your almanac."
He tipped his head to the side in a dog-like expression of bewilderment.
"Is that why I'm always misplacing it?"
"Yup. Also, you need glasses, honey."
Penelope was grateful for this insight about socks, for she too struggled with socks that went missing on laundry day, and this despite having an exceptionally well-organized stocking drawer.
"But why put a spell on the almanac?" she asked.
The fortune teller shrugged.
"Feeling ashamed is no good for the digestion. Freddy was using the almanac to try to keep his howling a secret. The sooner he got caught, the better. And old Timothy helped too, didn't you, you enigmatic cutie?"
The coachman looked smug.
"His lordship would circle the dates of the full moons, and I'd sneak in and change them."
Lord Frederick shook his head.
"You're a tricky one, old Tim, though that's no surprise. Well, I can't be cross about it, or anything else, really. Not today."
His blurry gaze met that of his new babies.
"Oh, would you, you little yappers," he crooned. "Oh, would you, woo, what?"
The baby's lips pursed into two round O's.
"Look, Frederick," Lady Constance said, all aglow. "I think they're trying to howl."
One would think there had always been babies at Ashton Place. Everything had changed, and yet it all came to seem quite normal as the days went by. An abundance of knitted sweaters and scarves began to appear on the household staff, which gave a cozy feeling to the grand house. Meanwhile, Penelope had returned to wearing her comfortable brown governess dresses, although she did ask that Madame Lepont alter them slightly. A fortnight in sailor pants had made her accustomed to having pockets, and she saw no need to give them up. Soon this, too, became the fashion at Ashton Place, until even Lady Constance began requesting pockets on her dresses, They came in useful for holding rattles and pacifiers and, of course, the occasional chocolate treat. However, there was another curious alteration at which no one could cease marvelling. After the night of the curse breaking, the portraits of Admiral Percival Rancine Ashton and the Honourable Pax Ashton that hung in Lord Frederick's study were never the same. They lost their long noses and pointed, wolfish ears. The expressions that had once been so cold and off-putting took on a warmer, more familial look. One could almost call them kindly. And the portrait of Agatha Swanburne, long in residence in the headmistress's office at Swanburne, now hung next to that of her twin brother Pax. Miss Mortimer supervised the installation personally. Penelope, Simon, and the incorrigible Lumleys gathered for the special occasion. Madame Ionesco was there too, as the spooky change in the paintings pleased her to no end. "Agatha belongs here, at home." Miss Mortimer stood back to admire the rearranged gallery of Ashton ancestors. From a certain angle, it looked as if Agatha and Pax were glancing at each other, a twin twinkle of merriment in each oil-painted eye. "And there is another, rather intriguing portrait of her at the British Museum that deserves to be more widely seen. I've arranged to have it moved to Swanburne as a permanent loan, courtesy of the Museum. Drat, I mean museum. Now you've got me saying it, Catterwoof." Cassiopeia grinned at hearing her baby word for museum come out of Miss Mortimer's mouth. "And both portraits of Agatha were painted by Pax himself?" Penelope asked, looking at the signature, a large, swooping A. It was how all the Ashton men signed their names. Miss Mortimer nodded. "Yes, Pax painted portraits of his sister his whole life long. As cruel as he was to her, he never forgot her."
"Since we're on the subject of art appreciation," Simon said, "what's up with Edward Ashton's portrait? The rest have gone positively cuddly, but his looks like the same as ever."
"I know what it means," Penelope said firmly. "It means he's still alive."
"Hang on, I'll see if I can find out."
Madame Ionesco squinted at the portrait and mumbled a few words of soothsayeries. The dead duck on the mantelpiece let out a single protesting quack, but the portrait of Edward Ashton remained unchanged.
"Hmm, you might be right, but don't worry, honey. He won't bother you anymore. I don't think."
"Is that another prophecy?" Penelope asked with hope, for the good fortune teller had never been wrong yet. The soothsayer shrugged.
"Call it my opinion. The dead are predictable, but the living, please, you never know what they'll do next."
Penelope was deeply relieved to think that Edward Ashton was no longer a threat to anyone, even if it was only Madame Ionesco's opinion. But where was he? No one knew. Admiral Forsay maintained that no one could have survived the journey across the sea in that tattered balloon, especially a person with no balloon-flying experience. Still, oddly, some weeks after the birth of Fern and Edward and all the dramatic events of that strange moonlit night, a letter arrived from Europe. It was addressed to Lord Frederick, and it was from his mother. After some pleasantries about her croquet game, she had been practicing a great deal and had improved tremendously, she said. She wrote,
"Ah, no, Freddy, allow me to share news of a more personal nature. I have made a new friend, a gentleman who goes by the name of Ward. He reminds me of your father, those dark eyes, and yet I know it is not him. Your father was so sharp-minded, so unflappable. Poor Ward is like a child most of the time. He plays croquet, not well, and sings sea shanties. He has a horror of dogs. Imagine! I pity him, but there is something easy and familiar about his company, too. Freddy, you know how stubbornly I believed your father was still alive and would some day return. But I have come to see that my belief was nothing more than a wish.
It is Ward, so like and yet so unlike your father, who has cured me of my false hopes. Perhaps that is why I feel so attached to him. My dear son, you have always had a good heart, and I imagine that fatherhood comes quite naturally to you. I look forward to meeting my grandchildren as soon as the croquet tournament season is over. Ward sends his regrets, but he is not inclined to take a trip to England. He says he has travelled quite enough in his life and is utterly fatigued by it. The only place he might some day return to is the Alps. He longs to hike there in the summer months, he says, when the Edelweiss is in bloom, for he sometimes has a strange feeling he left something there, something important, and that if he could only find it, he would be quite himself again. Did I mention he was enigmatic? Sometimes he reminds me of that old coachman of yours, your loving mother, now a grandmother too, Mrs. Hortense Ashton.
Mrs. Clark came upon the letter while straightening Lord Frederick's desk. To read it without permission could be considered a kind of eavesdropping, but it was there in full view, and she was only human, after all. Wisely, she decided to keep its contents to herself. After all, a letter from one's mother is a person's private business, she reasoned, and I've no intention of starting any wild rumours, especially ones that might trouble the sleep of poor Miss Lumley. Surely she's had enough excitement already. Still, it was a credit to the British Postal Service that a letter from so far away could arrive at Ashton Place so quickly, especially given the vast quantities of mail they were suddenly called upon to deliver. For Ashton Place was positively buried in congratulatory notes and baby gifts. Lady Constance delighted in each one, and she personally wrote countless prompt thank-you notes while the babies gurgled in their cradle. "I am setting a good example for the children," she explained to Margaret, who could scarcely believe her eyes. "One is never too young to learn good manners. By the by, there is a letter here addressed to Miss Lumley. Will you bring it to her? This mark on the envelope has been made to resemble the royal seal. Someone must be playing a joke on our governess. Ha ha!" Margaret did as she was asked, and naturally, she too thought the letter was a joke. Penelope knew otherwise. After a few deep, calming breaths to quell her shaking hands, she managed to slit open the envelope and unfold the letter within.
"My dear Miss Lumley, or shall I call you cousin? I am writing with regard to a bill from the Grand Hotel in St. Petersburg, Russia, which was sent to my particular attention at Buckingham Palace. Am I right in deducing that these charges were incurred by you? A night in the royal suite, flowers, chocolates. I am fond of chocolates myself, so I cannot object. And an entire wagon load of beets. You must have developed a taste for them while travelling abroad. Personally, I prefer a dish of good English peas. I have been to St. Petersburg only once to attend the wedding of an old school friend of my husband's. The Tsar insisted on giving us tickets to the ballet, as he is absurdly proud of it, but to be frank, Albert and I are more the types who enjoy a good cricket match and a beer, followed by an early bedtime. In any case, we were starving. We skipped the ballet and went to dinner instead. But after your bill, I ought to tell you that my steward was quite cross, as he had no record of approving such an expense. He brought it to my attention during our weekly budget meeting. Yes, even the crown must keep to a budget. Castles tend to be draughty. You cannot imagine the amount of firewood we go through. I recognized your name as the young governess who had written to me in such a heartfelt way a year or so ago, expressing your concerns about the poor. A Swanburn graduate, as I recall. I assure you, I told the steward, Miss Lumley is not the sort of girl to run up an extravagant hotel bill and send it to her queen unless she had a very, very good reason to do so. I can only imagine what sort of predicament you must have been in, and I do hope that things have worked out happily for you and yours. I have instructed my steward to pay the bill in full, and you may put the matter out of your mind. However, if there should come another occasion when you have need of the royal purse, I encourage you to ask permission first. Failing to do so sets a poor example for the little princes and princesses, never mind the members of Parliament. As ever, your devoted sovereign, Victoria, Queen of the Realm. Penelope was surprised to read this, for how on earth did the Grand Hotel learn her real name? But then she remembered how she had signed for the flowers and chocolates by mistake. This letter was not the only mail she had received. The previous day, a whole sack of mail had been delivered thanks to the Princess Popkinova. The old woman had had all the mail addressed to Penelope packed up and forwarded from Plinkst to Ashton Place. What a mountain of correspondence it was! Several months' worth of daily letters from the incorrigible children and Simon, and quite a few letters from Miss Charlotte Mortimer and Mrs. Clark, too. Simon lugged it up to the nursery for her, and grunted mightily when he put it down. Penelope hoped Svetlana had not had the burden of dragging the heavy mailbag back to the post office. Yet, who knows, she said to Simon, for she had told him all about the Russian girl. A trip to the post office may have been a window of opportunity for her to escape from Plinkst herself. I wish her well, though I expect I will never know what becomes of her. It is a strange feeling to meet people who make such a vivid impression and then not know how things turn out for them. Simon nodded. Just like going to the theatre. Once the curtain comes down, the story's over. Then everyone gets to imagine their own version of what happens next. His eyes took on their characteristic gleam. Think of us, for instance. How do you imagine we'll all turn out?
Us? You mean you and me, and the children, and everyone else here at Ashton Place? She thought for a moment. Well, I expect Lady Constance and Lord Frederick may well turn out to be better parents than anyone could have expected, and I would not be surprised if Fern and Edward grow up to be the best of friends and are as sweet and clever as two children could be.
A bit woofish, too, I'll wager, Simon smiled. And there's no harm in that, is there?
Certainly there is not, she said. As for the incorrigibles, she closed her eyes for a moment to better imagine it. Alexander could grow up to be a navigator and perhaps serve in the Royal Navy. Beowulf is so sensitive and creative.
A moody poet, perhaps.
I think painting is his true calling. Perhaps some day there will be an entire gallery at the British Museum devoted to his art. And Cassiopeia has a fierce sense of justice, don't you agree? And the courage to stand up to figures of authority in high dudgeon. I would not be surprised if she sat on the bench some day.
Simon laughed. Just so. The Honourable Cassiopeia, incorrigible Lumley. I can picture it clear as day.
The thought of little Cassiopeia in a white wig and judge's robes, dispensing justice with the fair, firm confidence of a true Swanburn girl, made Penelope grin from ear to ear. It was an amusing game to imagine what might become of each of them.
All right, what about Madame Ionesco? Simon asked, leaning back in his chair.
Penelope pretended to gaze into a crystal ball. It was really the nursery globe. I foresee the spooky madame will have very good fortune indeed. Her gypsy cakes will become an international success.
Simon paused. And Edward Ashton?
The question drained the laughter from her. He will have to sort out his own fate. I will not imagine a future for him, but trust that the scales of justice will weigh in suitably. Whom had she left out? Mrs. Clark will live on happily and dote on the babies. Margaret and Jasper may well start a family of their own some day. Old Timothy, well, he is quite an enigma.
Whatever the future holds for him, I expect there will be a touch of mystery about it.
Simon held her gaze.
And what of you? And me?
Penelope blushed, but did not look away. The incorrigible Lumleys, that is to say, my brothers and sister, will still be needing a governess. I expect I shall stay on at Ashton Place in that capacity for some time yet. But in years to come, who knows? I might like to try my hand at writing poetry or books of stories, like Giddyap, Rainbow, perhaps, or something altogether different.
He nodded approvingly.
Say, I like those pony books too. And don't forget about the Bard of Ashton Place, Mr. Simon Harley Dickinson. What's his fate, I wonder?
I shall have to check my crystal globe. She gave the nursery globe a spin, closed her eyes and imitated Madame Ionesco once more. Your pirate play will be a smash hit in the West End. The crystal ball don't lie, honey. Your show is a hit. Or was. Or will be.
He bowed to his imaginary audience.
Thank you. Thank you.
That prediction was music to Simon's ears. Pleased, Penelope kept up the Ionesco act.
You will have a long voyage ahead, she intoned, waving her hands over the globe.
His face changed.
A long voyage, he exclaimed.
Clearly he was no longer playing.
Wait, are you sure you're not just pretending to be a soothsayer?
Simon, do you mean you are setting sail once more? So soon?
To say her heart sank was an apt metaphor, considering the subject. She swallowed hard and tried to sound brave and cheerful.
Although, I suppose, knowing your love of seaborne adventure, I ought not expect you to stay on dry land for long.
He fidgeted in his chair.
Funny you should mention the sea, he said. Penelope, I've been thinking.
About what?
She said, her voice squeaking like Margaret's.
About, well...
He cracked his knuckles, pushed his hair off his forehead, tugged at his collar.
All right, I might as well spit it out. I've been thinking about Bertha.
This was not what she had been hoping to hear.
You mean Bertha, the ostrich?
She replied needlessly to hide her disappointment. He leaned forward, excitement shining in his eyes.
The very one. The big bird's got to get back to Africa somehow.
He took the globe in his own hands and turned it from one hemisphere to the other.
What do you say we take her home? From rainy England to the sun-bleached sands of the Sahara?
Either time had stopped, or her breathing had, or both. A trip to Africa, with Simon.
What fun it would be, and yet Bertha surely deserves to go home as much as any of us do, she said carefully. But if I may be frank...
You may, of course.
Thank you. Well, I have only just gotten home myself, and I confess I have grown weary of train schedules and troikas, seasickness and hot air balloons.
He stroked his chin.
You've got travel fatigue, and no wonder. So you'd like nothing more than to stay put for a bit, then?
I would, she gestured at the heap of mail. As you see, I have a great deal of correspondence to catch up on, and the children have hardly had a proper lesson for months. But Simon... If you want to take Bertha home to Africa, by all means.
I do, he said quickly. And at the same time, I don't. On the one hand, it would be a grand adventure. But on the other hand,
he sat up, scratched his head, and then wrung his hands in a nervous gesture that would not have looked out of place on Nutsawu.
Well, as we've just established, he finally said. You've just gotten home, which is a powerful argument in favour of me staying put. And then there's Fern and Edward to consider. I am the baby nurse, after all. I can't just pick up and leave. I've got important responsibilities, or Mrs. Penworthy does, which is the same thing.
Penelope started to laugh.
No, don't laugh. It's all quite serious, he said, though he was laughing too. And I'd like to get to know your parents. They've got heaps of stories to tell, and I do love a good plot twist.
His voice softened.
I expect you'd like to get to know them better too. You've all been apart a good long while, to say the least.
Indeed, they had. But no more. Mater and Peter Lumley had... had declined Lord Frederick's invitation to live in the grand house at Ashton Place, but had happily accepted his offer of a small cottage on the grounds. They would run a bookstore, give painting lessons, and assume Madame Ionesco's bakehouse duties when she was off prognosticating, for they had surely learned a thing or two about baking while in Frankenford. The incorrigible Lumley children would live in the cottage with their parents, but the nursery would also remain theirs to enjoy, and they would be free to come and go as they wished. As for Penelope, she was too fond of her lovely room to leave it altogether, but she also rather liked waking up in her parents' cottage to the smell of coffee and shaving cream and lavender water, and it seemed right that she too should come and go between them as she wished. After all, at 16 she was nearer a grown-up than a child, but she had missed a great deal of what most people think of as childhood, and now she could have her fill. Happily, there was no rush about any of it. The brave adventure of growing up, or the sweetness of being a well-loved child, safe under her parents' roof. Truly, she had all the time in the world. Simon was giving her the most tender, cow-eyed look.
"I am grateful that you understand my position," she said. It came out rather formally, for a lump had formed in her throat, and she was trying not to cry.
"Oh, I do understand," he assured her. "I absolutely do. And I think, that is, I hope you understand mine. Meaning, if you'd rather stay put for a bit, then I would too."
She looked down at her hands, now folded neatly in her lap. His rested carelessly on his knees. The question of what it would be like to hold hands took shape in her mind at the exact moment his hand reached out and took hers.
"I believe, yes, I do understand."
Then she smiled, and so did he, and all nervousness left her, for it seemed a decision of sorts had been made between them. But all she said was,
"Do you think Bertha will mind waiting just a bit longer to go home?"
He withdrew his hand and sat up straight, grinning.
"Not at all. In fact, I think she's rather excited about the new babies. Nutsawoo's babies, I mean."
"Yes, Nutsawoo. The long-lost scamp had become a frequent visitor once more, usually with an adorable troika of squirrel babies scampering behind, and another grown-up-sized squirrel, too.
"I'm sure Bertha will want to see Nutsawoo's family grow up a bit before we set off," Simon continued. "Why, I saw her just this morning acting as a stepladder for the little ones to get to the high branch of the elm."
"An ostrich serving as baby nurse to a litter of squirrels," Penelope chuckled. "What are the odds of that happening, I wonder?"
"It's unexpected, sure, but what isn't?"
At that moment, the incorrigible Lumleys came racing in. They had taken to having parents as readily as ducks take to water, as the saying goes, and had already enjoyed a hearty breakfast prepared by their father. He had artfully arranged the plates to resemble Mama Wolf, with fried eggs for her yellow wolf eyes, crisp bacon strips for whiskers, and two halves of buttered brown toast for her alert, upright ears. During their meal, they had enjoyed some cheerful poetry read aloud by Mater Lumley. It was a lovely poem by Mr. William Wordsworth called "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud," although nowadays most people simply know it as "Daffodils," as that is what the poem is about. "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils." After both meal and poem were consumed, the incorrigibles said thank you very much, asked to be excused, cleared their dishes from the table, and set out in search of adventure. This is the proper way to manage having parents. After all, once they have been loved, fed, clothed, and educated, most children are well able to fashion their own entertainments, and the wise Mater and Pater will let them.
Interestingly, it is when children know their parents are close at hand that they feel most able to bravely set off into the world. There is a bittersweet irony in this, whose full meaning only becomes apparent when one has children of one's own. The incorrigible Lumleys began their days to do-a-woos by visiting Fern and Edward in the baby's room and offering some brief lessons in yapping, woofing, howling,